The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. And now for this week's episode. Just wash it all,
wash it all away. It will haunt you. Well, this stuff right here will make you into a sexual tyrannosaurus, like me.
Ladies and gentlemen, predators and prey. Welcome to the Movie Morgue, the Movie Autopsy Podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery.
And I'm Annie Neller.
And returning guest, friend of the show, Matt Guerrero.
This here is Macho Man Mateo. And I'm here to put some testosterone in this film podcast. We're not going to be talking about geopolitical relationships and Reagan-era economics. No, you need a macho man for a macho movie. We're bringing the thunder.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Okay. And today, we are covering the 1987 action horror, kind of weird genre to place movie, Predator, the seminal classic. And yeah, let's talk about context, because this movie is very important in the annals of history. And Annie, let's start with you real fast, because you have never seen this movie.
Yeah, no, I had no idea what I was getting into when I was watching this. I didn't know that Arnold Schwarzenegger was in this. I didn't know. I did not know that Carl Weathers was in this. I literally had no clue about this movie. Well, I've never seen the box for the Predator movie before. So, like, this is a movie for which I legitimately had zero context. Which is weird, because I've seen a lot of the Alien movies. Yeah.
All right. And Matt, I think you were the one who suggested this to us, though it's been 2 weeks, so that's a little hazy, but yeah, so tell us a little bit about your relationship to the Predator.
I have a very special relationship with the Predator, one that I can talk about after those lawsuits have gone away. When I was a kid...
Oh, cool, the restraining order's gone?
Yes, the restraining orders on Arnold Schwarzenegger and Shane Black have both expired, and I believe Carl Weathers is up next week. But, when I was a kid, I got, I had the flu, and I was one of those, oh, yeah, every time you sit up, you have to throw up, that kind of flu. And so, my dad stayed home one day, and so I was just, laying on the couch, just trying to keep as much of...
Oh, you had a Saturday morning.
Yeah, I had a Saturday morning, and, once I'd gotten, past the point where every single time I sat up, I was throwing up, I went downstairs to the basement to join my dad, drank some Pedialyte, and we had a back-to-back feature of The Predator and Be Cool. Not Be Cool, Get Shorty.
Oh, classic.
Yeah, and so, my dad, prefaced this movie with, now, son, you know how there are chick flicks? You know those movies that are just made for women? And this movie right here, this is a guy flick.
Was your dad constantly checking over his shoulder to make sure your mom wasn't coming into the room? Because that's the vibe I'm getting from this.
Oh, God. Yeah, you know what? You've seen Predator. If you're just a little bit into some gentle caresses over a, zygomatic arch of a skull, maybe, yeah. Otherwise, it's just good, wholesome fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And for me, I've seen Predator, I think this is my third time watching the film. I've seen it a couple times before then. This might be my fourth. And I've not actually cared that much for it. I remember seeing it and more seeing it as, required reading for modern horror, sci-fi, action stuff than actually really engaging with it seriously as a film, but I did like it, and I have always, I've loved the Predator creature more than the films in the past, because it is a brilliant and beautiful costume, it's an iconic design, and it's become I won't call it a media empire, but it's surprisingly well-traveled.
It's a resilient franchise.
Yeah, didn't the Predator fight Boba Fett once?
I wouldn't be surprised. Predator fought Archie, so,
There's an
Archie versus Predator.
That is true.
Was this in comics or
yes,
something?
Yes, comic book land has been very friendly to the Predator.
Yeah. Oh, Archie got crazy lately.
Yeah.
Wow. That's the funny thing is everyone thinks it's oh, no, it's this 50s fucking Americana bullshit. But, Archie comics are fucking wild, dude.
they're having the most fun.
And also, he hangs out with a he hangs out with the Predator, but also with the Punisher.
Yeah, Archie versus Punisher, that wasn't a thing. Yeah. There's also Afterlife with Archie, which is this wonderful, you know, like, hey, what if the zombie apocalypse happened in Riverdale? How'd that go off?
Yeah. And it's a whole comics imprint. Apparently, Sabrina the Teenage Witch is actually crazy good right now.
It's stupid good. Oh, man. The Chilling Tales of Sabrina are perfect.
So this is like a franchise that has penetrated into a lot of different media than it sounds like, which probably makes my lack of encounter with it that much more surprising, but whatever.
And the other thing that we'll say for general context is the Predator... See, and that's kind of annoying because the sequel train has kind of kicked into overdrive lately. So you've got the Predator, the Predators, AVP, like every permutation of any phrase involving the word Predator may or may not be a movie title. But regarding Predator 1987, there we go. That's an unambiguous way to describe this movie. Is a very influential film in a lot of the kind of cult pulpy genres that we like here on the Movie Morgue. So that's something that I think we're going to dive into a bit. So let's go ahead and go to reviews. And Annie, I want to start with you because you are the one who came into this one clean. You were the first one to see this movie free from sin. So let's actually hear your review.
I came into this clean as opposed to dirty.
Untainted.
Untainted.
Uncovered by mud.
God.
Just lather it all on.
So, I'm conflicted about this movie. On the one hand, I do think that this is a very important movie for the sci-fi, fantasy, horror sort of like genre, the mishmash of all those things. On the other hand, the politics of this movie, the sorts of things that go on within the screenplay itself, I find, like, objectionable. There were quite a few things in this movie that I found to be just outright either sexist or very racist. I will also say that I think it's particularly beautifully shot. And I think that's one of the things that actually makes Predator what it is. I'm going to give this movie a C+ for that.
Okay. How about you, Matt?
Macho Man Mateo has no need for politics. Macho Man Mateo has no need to reflect on the Predator's need and influence on racial dynamics in filmmaking. No, Macho Man Mateo focuses on the blood and the guts and the choppers. And this movie has so many choppers. Macho Man Mateo says, you better give this movie an A+.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and come in and...
snap into a Jack
Link.
I'm
going to give this...
Oh, it's not trademarked.
Okay. I'm going to give this one an A.
Okay.
And there are some things I think would be different if it were made today. And it's being made today. That's
the funny part about it. We're going to have Predator 2018 and Predator 1987.
Yeah.
But...
like, the joke would be your mom's vagina is rated E for everyone. That's what the joke would be if it was made today.
Okay. You know what? Weirdly enough, if I had to paint one criticism for the film at the time, it's just, like, get rid of Shane Black. Which is something that I would never say today. But... no, it is an important film to watch, and for historical purposes, it is so influential that that does ultimately weigh into things, but also for the time, this is a movie from 1987. The fact that there is any kind of racial politic at all, there's a whole subplot with, well, not really a subplot, but, like, there's stuff that goes unresolved and goes unspoken between, like, Blaine and Dylan, for example. And the fact that there's any kind of awareness whatsoever is like, hey, you know what? A for effort. And like the other thing is, again, it's the Seinfeld effect, is this is such an important and seminal work that's inspired and influenced so many movies that it does not feel, I think, fair to me to criticize it for some of the things that it did that became, you know, rote sci-fi military horror monster fiction stuff. So, you know, I could ultimately dock points if I wanted to, but I don't feel like that's in the spirit of what I want to be doing with this.
Okay.
Macho Man Mateo points out that Seminole has the word semen in it.
Okay.
Which, okay. I mean, is fitting for this movie.
You son of a bitch. Okay, so let's get into talking about... do we want to get into... I do think we want to get into mechanics for a little bit, because there is... Because, Annie, first of all, you said this was beautifully shot, and I agree with that. And there's a lot that I want to talk about that is really nice stuff in this. So, Annie, why don't you start with a favorite shot, just real fast.
I think my favorite shot is when the guys discover the chopper, and they're looking up at this fallen chopper. It's in, like, the first 15 to 20 minutes of the film. They look up at it. And we're seeing through their eyes this chopper. And then there's a gaze back at them. And they're lined up in this really beautiful inverted pyramidal composition. Like, I can't even describe it. It's just gorgeous. They're all set against the background of the jungle. They're all carrying weapons. And, I mean, that's what this film is really very, very capable of doing, is shooting heroic male bodies in a very classical way. And I really like that shot.
Hashtag accidental renaissance.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. This movie deliberately draws on Renaissance compositions for certain reasons.
There's actually a painting, and it's been kind of making the rounds again recently because of, you know, the whole meme economy or whatever, where, like, there's that thing where people just take cool pictures and just label them. But there's that moment between Schwarzenegger and Dylan where, you know, they're clasping hands. You son of a bitch. Like, that's a really memed up moment. But so, you know, you can label those two arms as different things, and they're cooperating. So, like, people have done paintings of that frame, and it's a great shot. It's a great frame. What about you, Matt? You got any favorite shots?
You know, it's kind of dumb, but I think my favorite shot in this entire film is when the predator is, you know, cleaning his trophy and pulling the spine out of his, you know, latest victim. And he's just standing in the trees, and he just, like, you get this beautiful sunset, you know, the jungle landscape. And he just waves a spinal cord attached to a human skull up in the air and just roars into the night. And it's just, I love that. I love me some monsters. And that's just probably the most monstrous moment in the movie.
Nice. I think for me, there's a couple, but I think my favorite has to go to the shot where Mac, they're all waiting and watching, and Mac is just shaving as, like, this obsessive idle twitch.
Oh, yeah.
And then he cuts himself.
Yeah.
And he keeps pushing, but the blade doesn't move. And you see the blood trickle and pool around and just start dripping down his face and intermingling with his sweat, and then he breaks it, and that breaks the tension.
Yeah.
It's such a good shot.
Yeah, and it's a really great moment too.
Yes.
Yeah. Quit shaving, you don't have a beard.
Yep.
Oh.
Oh, for the record, anyone listening to this should go ahead, pause this, go to YouTube, unless you're driving. Please don't pause. If you're driving, come back to it. But go to YouTube and look up Predator the Musical.
Go.
It's incredible.
Get to the YouTube.
Well, actually,
it's
just, do it we now. Can post that.
Get to the YouTube.
Oh, God.
So, yeah. There's so much going on in this film. And I think I just want to start by talking about the special effects, because that is one of the defining things about this film. And also, where there's a lot of really fun
trivia. So much fun trivia.
So, fun fact. This movie basically almost didn't...
Why was that, Doc?
There are so many... Actually, Matt, do you want to talk about this a little bit? Because I think you're a little bit more versed in the lore than I am.
Well, sure thing, Doc. Well, you see, the final design for the Predator is just really beautiful. I think one thing they knew from the start is they wanted to have something with mandibles. And I think that was like the only design principle they had at all. But they wanted to go with something, you know, the first draft of this was kind of more insect-like. And instead of, you know, the Predator that we know and love, it was a, you know, you can see test footage online of this big pink, because it was just the cheapest material they could make to reflect what it looked like, and they would, you know, pretty it up later. But this, like, pink lobster man who's just running through the jungle, and it's like, ah, I'm a lobster. And so I think they kept for the Predator mouth, like, that was originally the effects for, like, the lobster claws going stamp, snap, snap, snap. That's a lie. But yeah, that looked like garbage. And so they had already shot a bunch of the movie with, you know, and they were trying to make out, you know, figure what the hell they were going to do. And so they got Stan Winston on board and they're like, okay, go ahead and, you know, make a new guy. And so they did. But it almost got derailed again because they wanted to cast a young international action star to be the, you know, the eponymous Predator. And they got Jean-Claude Van Damme to... originally was slated to be the Predator. But Jean-Claude Van Damme was like, oh, you know, I think the Predator, he should be doing a, how you say, a scissor kick, a splits. And it was like, oh, no, actually, he's kind of more of like a, he's just kind of more of like a tall guy, you know, he just kind of looms and shoots people, like, I do the scissor kick. And, like, it didn't work out. And so, and then, and Jean-Claude Van Damme was like, you know, he was in the first test suit. And so he's running around the jungle. You know, there's, like, this big foam costume. Looks more like a mascot for a high school football team. And, he, you know, he backs out of the project. And so they had to, you know, they essentially, they had to pull the Predator out of their ass. And they did. And it's become one of the most iconic alien designs out there. And it's just so beautiful.
Yeah. Not only that, and first of all, Kickflip
Lobster,
new band name.
You have to do the Belgian accent.
We are Kickflip Lobster. We are here to rock your face off and kick you in the face. And also do the
splits. And then we go snappity snap.
Anyways, moving on. The other thing also is the entire script is predicated on having a workable visual effect for invisibility.
Yes.
And... that they greenlit this, I believe, off basically like a single shot of test footage that they had managed to get the visual compositing working on. And here's the thing. This was done in 1987. There were no digital effects back then. I mean, there were, but they were very rudimentary. This was all done using mats and an optical printer. Oh.
So good.
The other thing... yeah. So you'll actually notice there's, like, different, I guess I'd call them modalities of the invisibility effect. Some will look different. Some will have, like, those lines will be really clearly defined. Others will be, like, really, like, kind of more seamless. And, like, it's different if the Predator is still or if the Predator is moving or, like, running around on the frame. And so just everything about this film just kind of almost didn't work. So you had, you know, the red suit. They, by the way, they put a red suit on a monkey. They tried to have a monkey be the Predator for a short minute. It did. The monkey did not like the suit. The monkey did not like the suit and ran away and climbed into a tree. There's a photo of it somewhere. It's great. It's just this monkey in this full red suit, including the tail.
Oh, no.
It's so good. And so... not only that, the other thing that they was an important part of this film is that they, and I was actually really surprised to learn this, the thermal vision from the Predator is done using a real thermal camera. It's not made up in post. It's really done there. And the way they do that is actually really clever, because what they do is they have a 45 degree glass mirror plate, the same way they did the candle effect on Blade Runner, and they have the thermal camera plugged into that. Now, the thing is, the thermal camera was actually digital. Or not digital, scan line. Really low resolution. It's like a 240p YouTube video, basically. And so what they had to... because what they had to do was they... because it was a thermal camera, that would only get the red glowing parts and the rest... so they actually had to film the forest directly with a normal camera and then paint that blue later. But because the thermal camera was a monitoring device and not a film camera, it did not record to film. It recorded to a monitor. It projected to a monitor in real time. So they actually had to have the thermal camera go in along a cable into a van where they had the whole thing blacked out, and they had a film camera pointed at the monitor for that.
Wow.
It's crazy. So they had to have that van in the jungle, and so they also had to have that long-ass cable, and they had to keep, I think, the truck refrigerated to keep the temperature down because they were running a bunch of, like, heavy equipment in there. The other thing is also, it was constantly not working because they're in the fucking jungle. So once it goes above 93 degrees, you can't see people on that anymore. And so there's this lovely thing. I was reading this stuff about the FX, and constantly Joel Silver is coming in going, breach of contract, breach of contract, and threatening to sue the FX company.
Oh, man. And it's still such a great
It's movie. So lovely. It's like, yeah, no. So that was something I was really surprised to. Although this does teach us something very important. Because think about this. This means that Arnold Schwarzenegger has a cold nose, like a dog.
Yeah, definitely. Bark, bark. Bok, bok.
You will give me the pets now. Oof. Yeah.
You ever, okay, just a side note, you know, that's, you know, all wonderful knowledge. Have you ever noticed that no one who's ever doing, like, a German or Austrian accent ever does an Arnold accent? You know, like, there's no, like, no. World War II Nazi movie where someone's like, we have ways of making you talk. It's, like, not a thing. I've never heard that before. Arnie is his own, you know, special breed.
Turns out Arnold doesn't have an accent. He speaks perfect English. That's just how he talks.
Oh, good times.
Accent? What accent? Yeah. But no, like, the special effects on this work really well. And that's some of my other favorite shots, is the ones where the Predator just kind of... The ones where the Predator kind of bleeds in and out of the background, and you don't initially see him, those are great. I love those.
Really quite remarkable.
But yeah, and to go to the Predator suit design, like, for as late into the production as it came, it's such a gorgeous suit. Like, there's a reason that it's been so iconic, but also the, you know, prop people have been into it forever. It's just such a cool design, and it's very practical too. Like, it's all, like, I think mostly makeup application or rubber, but, like, it's very lightweight and so on.
The Predator suit,
and then, yes. Yeah, I don't actually know too much about it itself.
The Predator suit weighed 200 pounds.
Really?
Yeah, it weighed 200 pounds. It was very difficult for the actor who was in it to kind of, like, deal with the heat, because it was just so, like, Kevin Peter Hall had stories about, you know, like, really struggling. And I know that was also one of the issues for Jean-Claude Van Damme, too, was not just his height, but it was the fact that the suit itself was very constrictive, and they were in a jungle that was like 95 and 100% humidity.
Yeah, and this, you can't do the scissor suit. Kicks.
Okay, I didn't actually know that. Because
200 pounds of, you know, just rubber suit hanging off of
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to clarify a little bit where I'm coming from with this, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm throwing out unsubstantiated crap, is because a lot of what I know about this stuff comes from, like, prop making and cosplay communities, and I guess the technology has improved to such a point where, like, the design looks in such a way that you could build it. I guess if you had a more muscular figure, you know, you could build a more cosplay version that is rather light and lightweight, because the design is mostly meat, and then there's actually very little in the way of costuming on top of the creature itself.
Sexy fishnet leggings.
Yes, let's talk more about the group of seven, you know, Reaganite, muscly men, and their problems dealing with a muscular foreigner with dreads in fishnets.
That's so loaded for the 1980s. It's too loaded. It's like almost more loaded than what we have now.
You know what? All I have to say is, that's one sexy motherfucker.
Okay, please keep your slash fiction...
You know,
on your own time, we can provide a link in the show notes if you want.
You know, Doc, we'll give you again, that plug. When I write for Dorkly sometimes, and I make some galleries, and sometimes we do it based on pop culture. And I think one of my proudest moments was typing out for, you know, a gallery. I was talking about the new Predator movie was Predator's Daddy, Please Choke Me with Your Spine-Rip Hands. And that was, it's a professional and a career high that I never thought I'd reach. And I'm, you know, I'm here for
we all aspire to such creative heights. We really do.
Yeah. Which makes you realize what a callback that actually is, though, watching this again, is like how he, because here's the thing. Arnold is such a big guy. In any other movie, you're just like, oh my god, it's Arnold. Holy shit. But in this, like, he's tiny compared to the Predator. And, like, you kind of forget that. Which, by the way, can I just say how much I love how the Predator's wrist blades have joints in them, specifically so they can separate at head width so that he can pin his head to the log. It's just such a useless feature.
Oh, Predator, I love you so much.
Yeah. So I think we could go technical for a... like, we could go on for a while. But a one shot I want to call out to is the... how do you say this? The shot, the tracking shot where they lose, I think it's Hawkins' body. Mm-hmm. And you see... no, it's... I don't think it's Hawkins. I think...
oh, actually, no. I'm not sure. I think it's you're thinking of... is it Poncho?
Yes, Poncho.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's Poncho. Where they're looking for his body, they're spreading out, and they can't find him. But what they do is they walk past a leaf that's dripping blood, and the camera pans up vertically, following the trail of blood.
Yeah.
And as it's doing so, they're moving further into the field.
Yeah.
So that you can kind of see them for half the shot, moving away from the clue, and just not seeing it at all. And as you go up, you slowly track up, and the blood flow gets more and more intense, and finally you get up to the body. That's such a gorgeous shot.
Yeah, it is. Oh.
So one thing I actually find kind of fascinating about this movie is it has movements. A lot of movies kind of set one tone and ride it throughout, but this movie, it's almost like three or four different movies at times.
Yeah, the first act is kind of like a red herring.
Yeah, I kind of hate the first act. It's kind of boring. Not gonna lie. But also, like, I feel like there was a change in cinematography because, like, the first, like, 15, 20 minutes of this movie look kind of bland and boring. But then, like, once the Predator shows up, like, it gets much more vibrant.
Well, I can't comment on the first 15, you know, the opening act, but the director, John McTiernan, hadn't done, you know, many action movies up to that point. And so the studio's actual philosophy was, you know, we'll have the director direct the movie, but then we'll have the action director doing the action sections. And so the, you know, the big storming the compound scene where all the commandos actually get to commando and just be the badasses is noticeably less well shot, and like that's where all like the puns come in, versus like the rest of the movie, which is like pretty low key action movie, strangely enough. But like that's the
that does explain why that feels like a Universal Studios action part.
Yeah, that entire section was shot by a different director.
That's interesting.
That does explain a lot. Yeah. I think we're going to go ahead and go into some deeper cuts here, because I think that's kind of all we have for this movie.
Deeper cuts.
Not all we have, but like...
but like technically, the technical stuff.
Yeah, for the time, this was a technical achievement. It's beautifully shot. We could nitpick on the script a little bit, but not... like, I don't think there's really that much discussion to be mined from that. So let's talk about what this movie is. And I'm just going to start, with this one, but this movie is about Vietnam. Straight up.
How so, Doc? How so?
He's such a... okay. So, first of all, era it's made in, post-Vietnam. But the first thing that kind of clued me in, and like, the discourse for this movie already exists, and, you know, you pick up some of that. But one thing I notice is almost all of the weapons are period appropriate for the Vietnam War. The only real exception is the Heckler and Koch MP5 variants, because those existed at the time but weren't really used by the U.S. military. But all the rifles are made to look like M16A1s. M16, famously a Vietnam rifle that was recalled and retrofitted and made to work because it was notoriously unreliable. You know, you've got the M60 machine gun. It's not an M60. It's a different machine gun, but it's also inappropriate. You've got the minigun, which was a helicopter-mounted weapon used in Vietnam. The use of helicopters, which I think Vietnam is the first real iconic use of that in warfare.
Yes.
And, yeah, it's that, because that was something I noticed while I was watching this. And, like, they don't really say where this is. I think it's a fictional South American country, but the second that they kind of get in there, it kind of forgets that South America, and like, it feels like Vietnam. It just, it has that vibe. But also, it's about these modern military men, you know, these, you know, Reaganites, I think is what we've been referring to them. And they're facing an enemy that works by evasion, deception, and hunts them from, you know, the trees. It's the common popular perception of the Vietnam War is that the, you know, the guerrilla tactics of the Viet Cong were sneaky and subterfuge, and that they didn't fight fair, I think is kind of the popular perception from the time. And what this kind of does, I feel, is it takes, because our protagonists are, you know, these big burly military men with all this hardware, and they're very competent. We see them take out that compound, and, you know, as silly and action movie as it is, they're still, within the fiction of the universe, very competent. So the question is, what do you do, what monster can you make that scares, you know, a military American man? And the answer is the Viet Cong.
Yeah, and all of the stuff that you just mentioned really emanates from a white male-dominated narrative of the Vietnam War, which that's the typical narrative that we see play out in films about the Vietnam era. What I want to say there, though, is that the way that that narrative is framed is often like white men are the best, but people of color are they're not the best, so they don't survive. I see that happen so much in a lot of Vietnam War era movies. You also see, I mean, the very fact that we have a monster in multiple movies that is representative of the Viet Cong is incredibly racist. And it's the way that Americans are working out their anxieties and their memories about the Vietnam War and seeing the violence of it and thinking of it as animal violence, because it was so excessive a lot of times. And, you know, that was how the press framed the Viet Cong and how the U.S. government did as well, which is kind of interesting because the narratives that we see about the Vietnam era, they're not, the ones that we have now are really not about American soldiers doing, like, the My Lai massacre, right? It's not about that. It's about the horrors that they encounter when they go over there. It's not the stuff that they do. So it's a very interestingly framed story that's really structured in white male perspective, but also through white male dominance, because that's what Dutch's character is really all about, right? Like, he's the Mary Sue character. He's got all the skills, and everybody else is just sort of like somehow doesn't live up to his standard of ideal masculinity that is, you know, like white masculinity. What I will say about this movie, though, too, is that it very much plays on earlier images from other Vietnam era films. So Apocalypse Now, like, there's a scene of Dutch coming out of the water, and he's covered in mud, and it's playing on that. There's some references to Full Metal Jacket. So this movie is very much a part of the Vietnam War cinema, I guess you would call it. I don't know what kind of a genre this is. Like, it's part horror, it's part action, it's part adventure. But I think that barrier between those genres has always been really permeable.
So I want to ask you guys, actually, what kind of movie is Predator? Is it an action movie? Is it a horror movie? Is it science fiction? Like, where do we actually categorize this, because this actually influenced a lot of different genres, but I'm having a little trouble trying to actually nail it into a single hole.
Well, you know, I don't think that Predator actually fits well into just one hole. That's, you know, it's definitely it's a movie that goes for both holes and maybe like three holes. And if it's ambitious, maybe a little bit of hand stuff too, you know? It's just, it goes for everything. And I think the strangest part about it is it's got the monster design. It has the, you know, the over-the-top action with like the G.I. Joe cast of characters. But then, like, everything after that first fight is just suspenseful. There's no more, like, you know, one-on-one fights. It's just kind of a stalking and dread. And, you know, it just turns into something very strange. And then by the end of, like, you know, the second act, everybody's dead except for Arnie. And then suddenly it just becomes, like, you know, a Robinson Crusoe story where he's just, like, you know, setting up the traps, you know, doing his damnedest to, like, you know, lure the Predator. And it's like, you know, it goes from like kind of men against nature to like man against alien. And it's just, you know, man at his most primal, most primitive. Like, the only way he can beat the Predator is not via, you know, machine guns or grenades or, you know, anything like that. It's by traps. And like, he kills the Predator by, you know, a tree trap. He drops a tree on him and it, you know.
Yeah, he kind of drops a piano on him, and that's kind of the funniest thing in the whole thing. But that's actually something that's a connection I just made just now, is he does beat him with very Vietnam tactics. It's kind of a bit of an inversion.
Yes, there's a question of what that's doing, right? So that's, I think, part of the problematics of the film for me. This idea of Vietnam tactics being associated with the primitive is, I think... I think that's a common perception, and was a common perception at the time, at least by a lot of Americans. But to kind of move it outside of Vietnam, I wanted to segue from something that Matt said into an interpretation of the film that I have, which is that this is a film about the arms race. And it's doing that through this kind of story about Vietnam and about the horrors of war and the sorts of images of war that Americans had, because Vietnam was really one of the first wars where Americans had these images of excessive violence, excessive gore, and death. And I think that explains, you know, some of the gore that we see in this movie in particular. Like, it's very much dwelling on that through this creature, I guess. But it's also very much about an arms race, right? It's about this idea of who has the best technology. Because what is... not just the American soldier, but, you know, the American government and really the globe most afraid of during this period of time, which is 1987. The global arms race. I mean, like, there's punning on arms, like biceps. There's a focus on, you know, might makes right, which is a very Reagan-esque thing. There's also a focus heavily on weapons and the idea of impotency. Like, notice in that scene where they are... firing on the town, they're not really shooting at bodies, they're shooting at things. So not necessarily taking down an enemy either. And then by the end of the film, you know, we sort of have this story where he has to change his approach to defeat his enemy. He can't do it with weapons. He has to do it through outsmarting this creature using whatever technologies he can find around him. So I think this is very much about the arms race. Yeah.
See, I have a differing opinion. Is like, it's the same way I see this movie as kind of like a reaction to the Vietnam War, but not necessarily about the Vietnam War. Because like, yeah, it's the same way, like, same. Like, what's the word? Like The Dark Knight and like Batman Begins is all about 9/11. And it's like, it's all about terrorism. It's like, is the movie actually about any of that? No, it's about Batman. He's doing Batman things. He's Batman.
It's about,
well, it just changed it to, you know, what's the goal of the villains and how do they execute it? And, like, the goal of villains is chaos, and the only reason is because they don't really have a very clear goal. And, like, how are they going to do that? By literally spreading fear, and that's the three movies where they literally spread fear. Like, in the first movie, it's a fear toxin. Second movie, it's introduced a little chaos. and all that jazz. And then the third one is just, let's make anarchy and make people afraid, and that's the goal, and then we'll just destroy everything. And it's like, oh yeah, that we've, I don't know, post 9/11, like, you kept in the war on terror, the bad guys aren't trying to, like, you know, steal land, they're not trying to sink California into the ocean, they're just trying to inspire fear and make us destroy ourselves. Like, okay, yeah. And in the same way, I see Predator is like the reaction to, you know, the Vietnam War. It's like, yeah, it's what, you know, it's set in a world where, you know, the biggest, the baddest, the best, you know, is America and militarily, and you can tell that because they got the fucking G.I. Joes coming out there, you know, shaking hands and, you know, breaking fingers, and we see exactly just how good they are, you know, when they go up against, you know, I love this movie, and I cannot remember who the bad guys are for, like, the 5 minutes they're on the screen, what they're even doing, because they didn't actually do anything wrong, technically.
Right.
Because, like, they were just there doing crimes, I guess, and then they just decided that they were the ones who strung up and skinned the Marines.
Right, which is also another thing that can kind of help to contextualize this film, too, right? What was going on in 1987? All right, I'll fill in.
I was going to say, I wasn't even born.
Did the thing come out in 1987?
A thing did come out in 1987.
I think the thing was 88.
a thing did come out, and that was Iran-Contra. And Iran-Contra was something that was actually taking place after the filming of this movie. Iran-Contra comes to Americans' attentions in November of 1986, and this movie started filming in April of 1986, so a bit earlier on. At the time, America was trying to develop something called a sphere of influence. The Reagans believed that in order to prevent countries from going communist, they could basically fund revolutionaries to fight off communist regimes in South America. And this was their tactic for ousting communism during the Cold War. So they did some very illegal things and violated the Boland Amendment and basically funded a whole war in South America. So South America and Central America were very much on the brain during this time. And so I think the fact that actually they don't have to do very much for the Americans to fire on them is kind of significant. It actually tells you how primed the audience would be already just from what was going on.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the Reagan, I believe in my heart that it is not true, but the facts say otherwise. That's that one stuff. Yeah. Also, I just feel like a relevant joke here is, that's the problem with a capitalist revolution. You always run out of daddy money. You eventually run out of daddy's money.
Yep.
Suck it, Meghan McCain. Suck it.
I don't think Meghan McCain would do well against the
Predator. Okay.
I don't think so either.
No, I don't think she
I don't
would.
Think anybody on The View would.
But
okay, I need. I got the new Predator comes out. All right, I got the next script. It is, let's just drop the Predator in Utah and see what fucking happens. All right, everybody's armed. He only attacks people who've got arms.
Can we come back to the Predator in other movies pitches, because that's going to be a fun section. But the other thing I wanted to say is, that is the other thing I think that also places us very much in the Vietnam kind of, I guess, mindset or paradigm, you might want to call it, is this idea that they are deceived. Dylan lies to them, brings them in under false pretenses. You son of a bitch. And there's also some dialogue that kind of points in that direction. It's like, you can't win this. No, but we can get even. But this whole thing is, it's a nightmare scenario where they were brought in under false pretenses and they just want to get out. And the whole thing is a slog to get to the chopper. And what is one of our most iconic images of the Vietnam War? Last chopper out of Saigon. It's this death march to the chopper, and only two of them get out. And not only do only two of them get out, only one military man gets out. The other one is a woman they saved. And, like, you know, it's just... To make the optics kind of weird on this, this is kind of weird, is like, and I'm not, I don't really know too much about the cast beyond the central six or seven, I guess, but they almost don't feel Latino so much as they, I feel like, as depending on the shots, like the action movie stuff with the second unit, that does feel a little bit more South American, but like, it almost feels Asian. And like, I guess part of it is just the mindset of being in like a Vietnam aesthetic. But, you know, that's just kind of a thing.
Well, you know, funnily enough, it was shot mostly in Mexico. So actually all of it was in Mexico, but it was in a couple different places in Mexico. So yeah, maybe that's why I love it so much.
Yeah, I think part of what primes me to do that also is just a really specific thing, is the command tent that Arnie rolls the truck into. They're all, like, hanging out there wearing yellow headbands, and what that invokes to me is just Big Trouble in Little China.
Big Trouble
in Little China. In Little China.
God. Oh, sure, a better run. You invite me for that episode.
I love that fucking movie. Oh, yeah, no. Dude, you've got basically a monopoly on John Carpenter. Well, you and JB. We'll get to that. Like, there's a lot going on in this movie.
Do we want to talk about other themes, or what else is there that you wanted to move on to?
I think this movie does establish really well that skulls are rad, and you should get as many of them into your collection as possible, you know?
Okay, so I actually do have one thing I want to talk about. Is the 80s are kind of an important time for prop making. And specifically, one of the kind of film circles I've, you know, recently come into, and I think I've mentioned this before, is that kind of maker replica prop forum kind of people, you know, the Adam Savages and so on. And the 80s is, I think, where movies and prop departments start getting to this really interesting point where their props, and I think also where science fiction, like, because I think Star Wars was 77, right?
78.
That's kind of, I think, where this almost begins. And so the 80s is where everyone's looked at that and go, because The Predator has a lot of really interesting, I think part of the reason that it is so fascinating is there are actually a lot of props that are not, you know, just naturalistic things you can own. Because when you look at an action movie, you know, you have guns, you've got knives, you've got all this stuff, and that's just stuff you can go out, I mean, in America, you can go out and buy, but they're real objects from our real world. But The Predator actually has some fascinating props to him, not only just because it's a costume, but it's not just a costume where it's like, ah, here's this creature made of meat, and it stalks the shadows. It's, here's the creature, but also he's wearing this costume, and this costume has this technology. And I think the most fascinating thing is the Predator's medical kit. Because when I saw that, my eyes just went, excuse me? I mean, I've seen the movie before. I remember it being there. But the level of thought and detail that goes into that, and the level of world that it implies, because I think the fact that we know that the Predator feels pain really changes the stakes of the final fight. Because I think the final fight is a duel. It is a game of wits. It is a battle of wits. It is a confrontation between two
equals. Coyote versus Roadrunner.
And exactly. But I think without showing I think without the medical stuff, without showing that the Predator feels pain, and that there's a world and a technology and a different culture around these things beyond just the ritualistic violence of hunting, that it would still be man versus monster. But I think the final becomes man versus other man.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's really captured the imagination with, you know, why there's a Predator franchise, you know, and as opposed to like a Rawhead Rex franchise. You know, check episode 17, True Believers. But the Predator is, we get very little about him in the actual movie. And, you know, I'm just going to say him because I don't see any visible genitalia. So let's just go with it. The Predator, he's so alien, but his alien, not in the sense of like, I can't understand what's going on. Like, what is this saying? What am I looking at with, you know, like it, the alien from, you know, Alien franchise, the Xenomorph. It's just like something other and unknown. But the Predator is like, oh, this is like when you go to a restaurant, like for, you know, something you've never had before. It's like, oh, yeah, this is a Vietnamese food. What's Vietnamese food look like? I don't know. But there's clearly some things going on here. Like, I think this is like a salad. And like, oh, okay. And everything about the Predator is alien, but it makes, you can tell that it makes sense to somebody. There's a story behind every single thing there that if you could just, you know, got the right context, it would all fall into place. And that's what makes, you know, it so interesting, is he's so different, but there's like, you know, it's a complete package. There's something going on there. And that's why, like, you know, the Predator, Predator in comic book land has flourished for, you know, decades now at this point. Because people love filling in the blanks and telling more stories about, like, you know, the people, you know, the Predator people and where they came from and, you know, what their do, what their deal is, what their society is, what kind of person goes out to another planet and just rips people's spines out. It's just so fun.
Yeah. I want to make a point of comparison here, because I think this is an interesting contrast, because I've never owned any of the Predator movies. I've seen Predator 1 and 2. One movie that we did own on DVD, though, was Alien vs. Predator, the first one. And what I want to compare, though, is I want to just take a moment for both of you and compare the Predator in this film to any of the Predators in the in AVP. And in AVP, I feel like they're more just... they're more movie monsters than they are in this one.
Hmm.
With the possible exception of the one that marks its face and then has the girl mark her face. That's, I think, the only implication of a bigger universe. But for a lot of them, because I think there's like three or four of them. And it's just like, oh, look at this. This is my Predator glaive. This is my Predator arm blade. This is my Predator spear. It's like they feel like action figures. Whereas this one feels like a character. Huh.
That's an interesting point, and I can't disagree with you on that one. Yeah. This is, like, there was an old writing class I took. One of the teachers, you know, was saying, like, you always want to give your, you know, characters to do something that establishes the world outside of them exists. And it's like, you can get that as simple as have a character open their mail while having a conversation. It's like, oh, they get mail. There are bills. There's all this stuff. The Predator's med kit is that, you know, opening their mail. It's like, yep, yeah, it's a thing. He, you know, he's got a little med kit. He can heal some scrapes up and scrape up some boo-boos. And it's like, yeah. And I don't, you know, you don't see that same level of what, I guess, the mundanity of this alien world somewhere else in any of the other films.
Yeah, and I believe they brought that back for Predator 2, I think. I recall very vividly the scene where it's injured and it has to like cauterize a wound or something, or like a stump. Like, that's very vivid in my mind. Yeah. So the other thing is also, it has a very different aesthetic to everything else that the Predator is kind of wielding. Like, everything else is, you know, much more bone and chitin and, you know, like these weird, like organic ridges, even if they are artificial materials. But everything in that little case, and by the way, it's a gorgeous little case, like with a slide out kind of flat panel recesses and stuff. But everything in there is like shiny metal. Also, I'm pretty sure there's a redesigned corkscrew in there. Pretty sure one of the devices in there is just a corkscrew.
Yeah, you know, it's always nice to have a pop up open a cold one after you've cauterized your leg stump.
Yeah, no, of course. But like everything in that is, I guess, medical, is like sterile looking, is that clean chrome of like, you know, because if you've ever owned like an airbrush, you know that that doesn't stay chromey, and like, it's a practical tool. It gets grimy, it gets fingerprints all over it, it gets paint on it, it like over time it acquires the properties of being a tool. But there's a different aesthetic to something medical, because that has to be sterilized and kept in very specific conditions and made to be a certain way so that it is safe. Its purpose is to be pristine.
Mm-hmm.
And so having that is just such a stark contrast to everything else, because the Predator is very earthy and very grounded, and everything it does is kind of dirty.
Except for his blood.
So when you compare... No, no, his blood is neon rave blood.
Yeah, they made that by taking some glow sticks and mixing it with lube. Yeah. It's strange. You know, it's such a beautifully designed costume, and, like, you know, everything is, like, state-of-the-art and all that jazz. And it's, like, there's also some, like, just, like I said, the really, like, I don't know, backyard special effects of, like, how are we going to record this monitor? Literally point a fucking camera at a monitor, okay? Let's just do that. Like, oh, how we get the glowy blood? Make some glow sticks with some lube, guys. I don't care. Just figure it out.
No, it does work surprisingly well. So, Annie, let's back this up a little bit, because I do want to get to the Predator and other movies pitches. But we do need to talk a little bit about race in this film. And I figure we should start here before we get... Because I think that'll be a nice way to round things off, is just pitching dumb movies at each other. That'll be fun. But... what I said originally was that I'm surprised that there's any kind of racial awareness at all, is there is a look between Dylan and Blaine when Blaine spits on his boot. And, like, there's some elements, but what's really, I think, strange for me is how this movie does set up some of the pieces, but then everyone dies. And so it's all kind of, you know, tears in the rain. So I'm kind of curious if you had any angles that you wanted to start discussing this with, because there is a lot to unpack there. It's just, like, I guess for me personally, I find it somewhat inoffensive just for being of its time, but also for, like, none of it's ever, like, accepted or generally, like, I guess, lionized. Just everyone's a bunch of people that fucking die in the jungle.
Yeah, I'm going to have to give you some pushback on that. The racism in this movie is extremely explicit. This whole movie is about white male dominance. There's no way to get around that. That is how the plot is structured. That is how the characters are framed. The white male characters are allowed to dominate the other characters, and the main white male protagonist is the standard to which all the other characters are held. He's a Mary Sue character who basically has no flaws. Meanwhile, the characters of color in this movie and some of his other subordinates are defined by their flaws. And in particular, there's also some play with racial stereotyping in this movie, and I'm going to explain why I think that was. So, Dutch is, as I said, a Mary Sue. In the first scene of the movie, he's introduced to us as somebody who is, you know, like a pro, like he's the best of the best, he's the biggest, he's the smartest, all that stuff. And in that scene, he physically dominates Dylan. So Dylan is made to be a subordinate through this sort of act of physical dominance. That bicep grip that they do is just so explicitly a power dynamic. Like, you can't get away from that. Dylan is also this character who is dominated in another scene by another white character, Blaine. Blaine is a racist, and that's how he's introduced to us. He spits on Dylan's boot. And, you know, while I thought this was going to be an acknowledgement of racism in the Vietnam War, what it actually ended up being is this sort of, like, moment that's supposed to make us mad at Blaine for a second, and then at the middle of the movie, we're like, well, but he's a good guy, though, so, yeah, we're sad now. His death gets the most emotional reaction out of all the characters' deaths. He's given a burial shroud. His friend Mac calls him his best friend. Mac literally goes crazy over Blaine's death. So the white male characters very much maintain a sense of dominance, whether they're flawed or perfect. Doesn't really matter. The characters of color are defined in terms of their flaws, and they're also presented through the lens of racial stereotypes. And I want to say that when I'm talking about this, the reason why I'm talking about racial stereotypes here is because they're so blatant. Carl Weathers' character of Dylan is a trickster figure. He is the guy who tricks everyone into coming and to the space and, like, basically getting killed. This is somebody whose cunning ends up getting him killed. He is tricked by the predator who mimics somebody's voice, and that's how he dies. The character of Mac is a black man who has no control over his emotional faculties, who's driven mad. This character is deeply derived from these long-standing tropes of black masculinity as lacking in intelligent faculties and solely ruled by emotion. He literally loses his head. That's his death. Billy is a noble savage trope. Like, it's almost textbook. The noble savage trope is a bit different from some of the other forms of stereotyping with which people might be familiar because there's some positive qualities ascribed to it. The noble savage is typically a Native American character who is a tracker who helps white people in the plot of a story or a film. They have an innate sense of nature and an intuitive knowledge of forests, plants, and animals, as well as being able to tell people what happened in the past in a space. It's a kind of like a Sherlock Holmes character without any access to structural power. Billy is the one person who sacrifices himself for others. His death on screen is really sad for the audience, but you know, like, it's culminated in this really horrifying act where his spine gets ripped out. So I think that all of the actors who play these characters bring some nuance to the characters, and there's more to them than stereotypes, but I do have to say that the stereotypes used for these characters are so blatant that I couldn't ignore it. And as I was thinking about this movie, I realized why that might be. Jesse Ventura was involved in the WWF and would have been a very prominent name to bring WWF viewers into theaters to watch this movie. So I think that's actually who this movie was probably targeted for, were people who watched wrestling. And the kinds of racist tropes that they're using for these characters were pretty common within the wrestling world. And the structure of the film itself is structured so much like a WWF match. I can't even explain this to our listeners. But it definitely, this seems to be a way to target viewers specifically who watch the WWF and liked wrestling and bodybuilding and all that stuff, which was part of the 1980s, I guess we'll call it masculine culture. I don't know what else to call it. That also seems to be a reason why the white characters get to play these protagonists, even if Blaine is a little complicated and flawed. That was also very common in wrestling. White men got to play faces. They get to play the protagonist in the wrestling match. And for everybody else, if you're not the biggest white guy, if you are not white, you don't get to be that. You have to be a side character. For men of color who are in wrestling, they unfortunately are made to create characters that conform to stereotypes as well. So it's a very complicated world, the 1980s, but I think that's probably why this movie is playing so heavily with racist tropes and archetypes, and also arguably why the nerd dies first.
Now, you know, I hear what you're all saying, you know, but this is still a movie I give my A+ to, and I think calling it racist, or, you know, not racist. Yeah, that's what you're saying. But if I'm going to choose a different word for what this is, I call it antiquated. Because, like, you know, the movies of the 1980s are a completely different breed of what we get now. We've seen what they would make the movie as this time around. And so you got to look at it. I choose to look at it for its positives. And, you know, even if the characters are kind of tropey, it has that multi-ethnic cast where everybody is shown working in cohesion together. And it's got, like, you know, Richard Chavez is in there. You know, Sonny Landon's performance is fantastic. Carl Weathers is so cool. Everybody in the movie just does a fucking fantastic job. And, you know, even if it's, like, you know, drawing on old stereotypes or archetypes, they're all pretty goddamn badass. Like, Sonny, Billy in this movie is just so cool, you know? Like, it's very, it sounds kind of strange, but I cannot think of another movie, like, made in that modern, the 80s era, where, like, a badass person of color just gets to be a badass person of color who's cool. And not, like, complicated. The movie's not very complex in that regard. Like, it's, like, you know, the way it treats its horror and stuff like that is kind of sophisticated, as we were talking about. And, like, you know, but it's just, it's very surface level when it comes to everything else. And it's, like, I can really appreciate, like, you know, just, they're all just really cool dudes shown in an unapologetically cool light. And, yeah, it just...
Yeah, the multi-ethnic cast was definitely something that people were experimenting with in the 1980s. And again, in part, that brings me back to WWF wrestling. That was something that was a very common form of entertainment for people during the 80s. And as a result, audiences became actually more interested in seeing multiple races represented in their action films. So weirdly enough, like, as regressive as these sorts of tropes are, this was a genre that actually opened up new possibilities for action films, which is partly why today we have films like the Fast and the Furious franchise, which is very much focused on diversity, as well as the Expendables franchise, too, which comes out of a line from this movie.
God.
There is a direct line from this Jesus dude, fucking Incredibles.
Christ. Seriously?
I almost said the Incredibles for a second, and that would have been weird.
Oh, man. But, Jesus fucking Christ. I did not know this. So this and the Usual Suspects, so the Expendables and the Usual Suspects went to the same goddamn grade school, huh? That's what you're talking
pretty
about?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
What, one thing I actually find kind of fascinating about this film is kind of its relationship with firearms, because in this way I think it's actually very subversive, because firearms are basically worthless in this movie, and yet you have these big things like the minigun. I think this was the filmic introduction of the minigun. I think T2 kind of codified it, the handheld minigun.
This was the first usage of that gun, so Jesse Ventura was like, that's one of his major bragging points throughout his career, is that he was the first to use this.
This movie got two governors in it.
But,
just...
It did.
Two governors came out of Predator. Like, how many other movies have two governors in them?
No, that's fair. But, first of all, you have the minigun, which is the symbol of absolute, you know, masculinity. It's the biggest symbolic penis in the movie. It fires the most bullets, quote-unquote. And it requires the biggest man to wield it. So, you know, you've got, I believe Blaine starts with it, but then I think Mac picks it up?
No. Yeah, Mac picks,
who picks it up.
Mac makes his final stand with the minigun.
I thought Mac made his final stand with the
M16. No, you're right, sorry. Yeah, they're just firing impotently into the darkness at that point.
Someone else fires.
That was a great shot. They're just all firing. You know, there's no one screaming. They're just
they're all firing into the woods, into the jungle blindly. They're not hitting anything. But also, the minigun is seen as the symbol of masculinity. It's passed on, and it's wielded. But ultimately, it doesn't help. And
That's more about an over-reliance on technology and also the concept of masculine excess.
Thanks for the plug, Annie. Just letting you guys know, I am going to be starting a new podcast called Masculine Excess, where we just go over the action films of the 1980s, including next week's episode, Dude, Where's My Minigun?
You know I would watch that.
Coming to Stitcher in the fall of last year.
Have fun with the edit on this one, Annie. But I want to talk about Dutch for a second. Because actually, that's one thing that surprised me, is I really like him as a character. Because I actually think, unlike 90% of movie leaders, particularly military leaders, he's actually a good leader. he trusts his men, he delegates, he communicates effectively, and he's concerned for their well-being.
Yeah.
Like, beyond that, like, he trusts them, he can... Like, I think the best example is the military compound, because he just says, you guys, do you and you, do this, you and you, do that, I'll do this, you, cover our backs. And then he doesn't check in with them, he doesn't micromanage them. The team is cohesive, they understand their roles, and they trust and support and believe in each other. And that's, like, it's weirdly, that's a standard to which most action movies, like, most squad yeah. dynamics in film and literature don't hold
this
up to.
This is the future the liberals want.
But that's what a lot of modern action movies that are a sort of ensemble cast adhere to. Like, The Expendables, same structure. Fast and the Furious, same structure. Yeah. So it definitely got passed down.
Yeah. But even so, like, when you look at those descendants, a lot of those, they create drama or tension by, like, playing up the infighting and the dysfunction of such a group. Because it's ultimately about a group triumphing despite their dysfunction and their infighting. It's like, I guess we are a family after all. Whereas this movie establishes them as a cohesive and wholesome group and then tears them apart because it's killing them off.
Yeah.
So, whereas a lot of... And I think, like, you know, the action movie legacy of this is these dysfunctional groups that kind of pull things off. This is a functional group that is basically tragically torn apart.
Yeah, this is... It's just kind of riffing on that. I think one of my favorite sequences in this movie is when Mac, you know, ultimately just loses his shit completely. And it's like a thing I don't think I'd actually ever noticed this the first time around, not the first couple of times. I've seen this movie too many goddamn times. But, you know, this latest one, I noticed it for the first time, was that when Mac loses his shit and just kind of, like, you know, breaks, he starts singing the background song from the helicopter, Long Tong Sally. And at that point, it's completely unrecognizable as the song we were hearing before. There's no tune to it. There's no passion to it. It's just repeating words, and he just starts, like, you know, going to the ooh, and it just doesn't sound like that at all. It just sounds like a man screaming into the, you know, screaming into the void. And it's just so great.
Yeah, Bill Duke's performance in this is so incredible. Like, it's very intense. And I did actually want to come back to Mac when you spoke up about that, because one thing that I find kind of interesting is there's a lot of jokes about the 80s and, you know, the movies that descend from the same cloth, that, you know, it's all about homoeroticism and, you know, just a bunch of sweaty bros just hanging out.
Listening.
But, and we can talk about, you know, the whole Dumbo sequence where they're just, you know, setting up all the snares and they're all shirtless and tugging on ropes together in a big line. Because there's a very big base level of homoeroticism in this film.
Listening.
But with Mac specifically, and this is, I think, what kind of complicated my thoughts on, like, you know, the racial politic of this movie, is that Mac seems to have more homoerotic undertones, specifically with regards to Blaine. Because he loses his shit after Blaine's death. I'm going to carve your name into him. I'm going to carve your name into him. I'm going to get that son of a bitch. He's talking in the void. And so, like, that strikes me as, like, and maybe I'm overreading into this, but it strikes me as being, maybe it was unrequited, or maybe there was something going on, but it kind of complicates the character of Blaine, where I feel like he had this, I guess, more intimate relationship with another black man, but you have Dylan, who is the black man who is the outsider, who he's overly aggressive to. Like, I'm not sure how much of this is me trying to project and trying to dig for meaning where it doesn't exist, and how much of this is just stuff that's actually in there, because there's a lot
well,
there,
it's
but...
very, it's very know, difficult guys... to say, because in the novelization of the film that came out, when the film came out, Mac is white. So, I think that's one of the things that fascinates me the most about this film, is I know that there were different intentions for different things. Like, for instance, Shane Black's character got killed off because he was needed at another film set. But the way that his death comes off is it's like, kill the nerd. The thing with Mac, though, is that if we're looking at the text of the film, this sort of desire for Blaine that we're talking about, which is a queer desire, is expressed towards somebody who is explicitly racist. Like, that is the way that Blaine's character is introduced. He's introduced as a racist. He's introduced as excessive. He's too much. He does too much.
He is, in fact, a sexual Tyrannosaurus.
Yes. Not just...
Yeah, he is introduced as a racist in a cowboy hat. We can't let that fly. That is a big part of his character.
Yeah, and you know, I think, was it you that I talked about the Tom of Finland illustrations with?
Oh my god!
I wanted
we
to
would
bring
be
up
talking about Tom of Finland on the Predator episode.
Tom of Finland, because that was the first thing that I thought of when I saw these guys in this film. Like, I was like, oh my gosh. All of these guys look like Tom of Finland illustrations, and the racial dynamics in Tom of Finland illustrations also operate in a similar manner, where black men who were typically positioned as, you know, hypersexual and hyperphallic in a lot of mainstream stereotypes are positioned as the ones who desire the white man's body. And yeah.
Oh, that's Tom of Finland.
That is Tom of Finland. And there's also a lot of stuff with mustaches, with cop uniforms. Like this idea, not just of sexual domination, but of a very specific power dynamic. So yeah, that was what that made me think of. I was like, ooh, somebody needs to, if they haven't already written about queer desire and Predator and linked it to Tom of Finland. There's your article.
I'm just saying, I would very much like to see the Predator of Finland. That would be
somebody on DeviantArt needs
Matt, I have such sites to show you. Let me just No, I assure you, you can find what you're looking for. You just need to know the right places. So, let's end on a high note here, because this is such a fun, and I think part of what makes the Predator so fascinating is, I think how it's, I think it's part of the premise of it. Because part of the premise of the Predator is, the Predator is kind of this holistically complete package. It's a character that comes with an inherent story, motivation, and contrast. So, when you look at the film Predator, it's, what if you had Iranian and Contras, but, sorry, not Iranian, sorry, if, what if you had South American Contras, but also inject the Predator. What AVP is, what if you had aliens, but inject the Predator? Predator 2 is Predator in the big city, you know? Or, you know, Jurassic Predator 2. So that, I think, is part of why he's kind of fun to talk about in fan circles, because you can add Predator 2 things, and the story kind of writes itself. So... Let's just go nuts with this, and I want to see, like, what movie would you add the Predator to? Let's just have some fun with this.
This is a good question.
Well, I'm going to start. I want Predator in a Scooby-Doo movie.
Annie, do you have any ideas what Predator would fit just right into?
Oh, man. I think dropping him into the Avengers would have actually made it an even more interesting film, and I think it probably would have had a little bit more longevity.
I'm sorry, because when I think of, when you say Avengers, I'm specifically thinking of Avengers 1, which is the only time I think they really tried to do like those like Marvel Ultimate Alliance combo attacks. So I'm just picturing them like trying to have, like, you know, doing the Predator doing a fastball special off Cap Shield or something, and it's just the funniest mental image.
All right. Now, I think that the perfect movie ever made, all the Oscars, might just be, you take that premise for that Beetlejuice sequel that's been spinning around Hollywood forever, and it's called Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian, where Beetlejuice has to, like, somehow win a surfing competition, I think, in order to, you know, to defeat a Hawaiian god who is also a volcano, I believe is the premise of this.
Okay.
You know, this script, it's been written, it's been floating around, like, you know, they've been trying to get it off the ground for years and years. Michael Keaton might still be on board, who knows? But I'm thinking maybe Predator Goes Hawaiian. All right? which is just a Hawaiian vacation, and you just like drop Predator inside and see how it goes. You know, like, hey, everybody.
I've got a great one. I've got a great one. Predator treasure. No, because think about it. Because when you look at the AVP thing, that whole thing is of the secret history about how like the Predators have always been coming to Earth.
Which, I mean, that kind of works so when you think about the fact that Jesse Ventura was Alex Jones before Alex Jones was Alex Jones. Like, I could see Jesse Ventura showing up in there to be like, they've always been here.
We're more like treasure protectors.
No, guys. Predator and Face Off. John Travolta has to switch faces with the
that
Predator.
That doesn't even make sense.
But nothing in Face Off made sense. And I think that was why we liked it.
Now, I'm telling you, the solution is 10 angry predators. In which Predator is, like, you know, he's held up on all these, like, spine rips.
Uh-huh.
And be like, hey, man, what's going on? Like, that was not cool. This is illegal. And it's just up to, you know, one lone jury predator who's like, click, 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 click. Which means, you know, this is totally okay within the confines of our predator law, and he has to convince the rest of the jury that Predator has to go home free. Maybe Pride and Prejudice and Predators?
Ooh, I mean,
the alliteration gets me there.
I would have. Why didn't that author think of that when they did Pride and Prejudice and Zombies?
It is. I'm telling you guys, it is a truth universally acknowledged that a predator in possession of some wealth must be in want of a shoulder cannon.
Here's an interesting thought. Yeah. Here's an interesting thought. Oh wait, no, I'm sorry. I've just won this one. Mm-hmm. E.T. but the Predator.
Fun fact: when they pitched the screenplay for Predator, they pitched it as Rambo meets E.T. in space.
Okay.
Huh. All right. So, I think I've got my last pitch.
What is it?
Terminator 2, but with the Predator coming to save John Connor.
Counter pitch. Terminator 2, but with the Predator coming to kill John Connor.
Better pitch. Terminator 2 with two Predators.
At some point.
Counter pitch.
Oh, no.
Terminator 2, where Linda Hamilton is a predator.
Oh, okay. I'm on board.
Okay. Counter pitch. Terminator 2, but we've replaced every single character with a predator.
Counter
pitch. Just little tiny John Connor predator.
We do Terminator 2, every character is predator, and we just have the soundtrack as Long Tall Sally, going over and over again for the entirety of the film. And then the credits roll, and we play Long Tall Sally. I like it.
You realize this is just going to turn into the Salt and Pepper Diner? Like, people are just going to be like, I hate Long Tall Sally. You're going to play, like, a single clip of What's New Pussycat, and people will weep with joy.
Oh.
Anyways, I've been Silvio Emery. You guys can follow me on Twitter at DoubleDocMD.
And I've been Annie Neller, and you all can always find me on Instagram and Twitter at Lights and Music.
Yeah. Matt, where can people find you and your work?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter. I'm at Spook Show Cinema, and sometimes I put things on Dorkly, and they let me keep them there. It's fun times.
Well, there you go. You guys can follow us on Twitter at MovieMorgCast. Please remember to like, comment, subscribe, review wherever it is that you get your podcasts. That being said, I also stream on Twitch at DoubleDocMD. You guys can check that out. Got that whole thing revamped now. And our intro music, as always, is Trouble by Ipso Factopus. Find a link to their Bandcamp in the description. And thank you guys so much for supporting us, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Get to the podcast!